Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2004, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a politician. He's very clever, he plays the guitar, likes cats, football and the Beatles, and has been married for 30 years to a beautiful ex-model, all of which you might think would make him a popular figure on the political scene. The truth is rather different. Born and brought up in Wales, the son of a Jewish Romanian immigrant, he went up to Cambridge and became president of the Union. But while his contemporaries sauntered into Parliament and then into office, his climb to the top took much longer. And even then, despite holding senior posts in government, his party seemed reluctant to accept him as its leader. 8 months ago, everything changed. Demoralised, the party finally turned to the man who, despite his adversities, had stayed loyal and whose experience and stature they recognised they needed. "I've always taken the view," he says, "that other people can decide what you can do and what you can't do." He is Michael Howard. That must be a judgment, Michael, forged by experience rather than something that you've always worked on.
No. I think it is one of the crucial things about political life. It's actually true that other people decide what you can do and what you can't do. Well, it's true.
But it almost makes you sound sort of passive, you know.
Oh, no.
Less than ambitious.
Oh, no. Well, I'm not passive because I think what you've got to do is to do whatever job you're given as well as you can. And if you do that job to the best of your ability, others will then decide what should happen to you next. I mean, I wasn't one of those people who, when I was at Cambridge, sort of sketched out a career which ended up at 10 Downing Street.
The route map to Downing Street was not.
No, I didn't think you can plan it like that.
Well, I suppose it's a good job you felt like that, really, isn't it? Because, I mean,
probably.
In 1997, when it didn't happen for you and you were rejected as the leader and came fifth out of five, you must have thought, well, that was it. You know, if there had been any route map, it was certainly torn up then.
I did, but there wasn't a route map. Looking back on it, I think it... The party came to the right decision, probably.
What, at the time?
Yes. It was probably a good thing to sort of strike out in a completely new direction with someone who wasn't as closely associated with the previous government as I was.
Certainly it would seem that the prize was never going to be yours. You were never going to become leader. And then suddenly, as I said just now, it all changed last November, and there you were, anointed, unopposed. How surprised were you?
I was astonished. It was not something I ever thought would happen. And if we'd been sitting here a year ago and you'd told me that I'd be sitting here today as leader of the Conservative Party, I'd have said that you were prone to fantasies.
But are you suggesting that you never did anything to square the other contenders behind the scenes? You know, Tim Yeo, David Davis, Ken Clark?
I didn't. No, I didn't square anybody after the vote which decided Ian's future had been taken. Obviously, during the week between that decision and my election, I did talk to lots of people at that time, not to square people, but obviously a lot of conversations take place.
But someone
must have
been making the calculation. Somebody must have been saying, look, all stand down and let this man go forward.
I really don't think it happened like that. I think the Conservative Party suddenly realised collectively that the strongest signal it could send to the country that it was putting aside all the arguments and difficulties that we'd had for so many years was to avoid a contest and to agree on someone.
But Ken Clark muttered about a right-wing coup, didn't he?
Well, I did talk to Ken at that time, and he came to his own decision, as they all did. There was no...
But what did you say? You
conspiracy.
Said, look mate,
was,
you're not going to get it because of the European thing. Let me run. This is what we need in this moment.
Oh, I didn't say that to Ken. You try saying that to Ken.
Tell me about your first record.
Well, the first record is a Beatles record. And I could have filled the programme with eight Beatles records because I adored their music. I was a very early fan. I still have a copy of their first album, which says on the sleeve, "The Beatles are the biggest thing to hit British show business since The Shadows." And I've chosen All You Need Is Love because it's perhaps the sort of quintessential record of the 60s.
Beatles and All You Need Is Love. I heard that as Home Secretary you had that kind of music blaring, you know, full blast in the ministerial car the whole time. Is that right?
Sometimes. Not all the time, but, yeah, there were times. It's great music.
I also gather that you were enthralled to Elvis and that at some point in your boyhood you were the leader of a skiffle group.
I did do a bit of guitar playing in a skiffle group. We were a sort of Lonnie Donegan clones.
I thought you looked more like Buddy Holly with the square glasses.
Well, I was very keen on Buddy Holly too. Actually, now you mention that, I feel very guilty. I haven't got a Buddy Holly record amongst my eight.
But, Michael, it has to be said that all of these details and the way in which you speak and present yourself here, you know, bear witness to the fact that you're a paid-up member of the human race. Why is it that that is not, and or hasn't been anyway, the public perception of you? The public perception has been, as you know, that you're ambitious, driven, less than caring. Why has there been such a gap? Why have you signally failed to transmit yourself?
I'm not sure. I think probably a lot of it has to do with my time as Home Secretary. Looking back on it, I'm very proud of what I achieved as Home Secretary because we managed to cut crime very significantly. But it was a real hard slog. It involved taking on some of the most determined, entrenched lobbies in the business.
So you sacrificed...
And it was full of controversy.
You sacrificed your personal image for that, do you think? Do you feel, looking back?
I went into politics to do things. And you have to accept there will be times when you will be unpopular, but that is a necessary thing to accept if you're actually going to make a difference.
In a sense, what you're asking the nation now to do is to accept a public reinvention of yourself, rather as Michael Portillo has done. I mean, it's what's required by the marketing that we now have in modern politics, isn't it?
Do you know, I don't see it that way at all. I mean, I have changed. We all change as time goes on. We get older, we learn from our experiences. But I look back to Margaret Thatcher, who was not always the most popular of people, but who, I think, achieved great things for this country and did so because she knew what she wanted for the country, she knew what she believed in, and she stood up for what she believed.
Record number two.
Record number two is the Morriston Orpheus Choir version of Cwm Rhondda. It is an absolutely wonderful hymn, and I love shouting it out. And, of course, it reminds me of my boyhood in Wales. Morriston isn't very far from Llanelli. And it's also, of course, the sound you hear on the terraces when Wales play rugby. And it's a great sound.
Cwm Rhondda, Bread of Heaven, with the Morriston Orpheus Choir, led by Alwyn Humphreys, with the organist Alan Dregellis-Williams and Joy Amon-Davis on the piano, which takes us back to Wales, Michael Howard, to Llanelli, where you were born 63 years ago this week. Happy birthday.
I was born in Gorsainham,
which
is a village between Llanelli and Swansea.
And your parents ran shops?
Yes, that's right.
What sort of shops?
Ladies' fashion shops.
And your mother had been brought there, I think, aged 6 months from Eastern Europe, but your father arrived as a man in just before the war, didn't he?
He didn't arrive in Llanelli before the war. He only arrived in Llanelli when he met and married my mother. He originally came to London to be a cantor in a synagogue, and that was why he left the place where he'd been born.
Which is this area of Romania we call Transylvania. I mean, do you think life had been tough? I think it was 1936 he came.
That's right.
It?
He left in 1936.
So the fascist organisations, yes, would have been...
There were clouds on the horizon. It perhaps hadn't started raining yet, but there were lots of clouds on the horizon. That's certainly true.
So he came alone, met and married your mother, as you say, and settled in Wales. What about the family he left behind? What happened to them?
His mother, my grandmother, was killed in Auschwitz. His sister also went to Auschwitz, but actually survived. and came and lived with us in Wales, and indeed carried on living with us until she died. My uncle, his brother, was also in concentration camps, also survived, and happily is still alive.
So did you talk to that aunt who lived with you about her experiences? What did she tell you about Auschwitz?
She had an astonishing story to tell. She had actually been in a gas chamber three times and had, for various reasons, once because they'd run out of gas and on other occasions for different reasons, had come out and lived to tell the tale.
It's amazing, isn't it? And what effect did that have on you when you listened to these things?
Pretty harrowing.
And did all of that then serve to strengthen the family's Jewishness?
I don't think it did, funnily enough. I mean, I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish home, and so there was a great deal of Jewish consciousness in the home. But the Holocaust affected people in different ways. In some cases, it made people want to forget the fact that they were Jewish altogether. In other cases, it strengthened it. I don't think in my aunt's case, which you're particularly asking me about, I don't think it had either of those effects. But it ruined her life, not surprisingly.
Mm. Your father died, actually, didn't he, when you were a young man?
He did. He died when I was 25.
Did he live?
He was 49. He died of breast cancer, which is pretty unusual in a male. And he was a great influence on me, and I miss him still.
Did he live to see you fight an election?
He did, just.
Really?
I fought my first election, which was again completely unexpected, when I was 24 in March 1966, the 1966 general election, and that was 4 months before he died.
Mm-hmm. I bet he was proud, wasn't he?
He was. He thought and frequently said that this is the best country in the world and we were all privileged to be here and we should always remember that, which I certainly do.
Record number three.
Record number three takes me back to those years in Wales and the early years of rock and roll. And there were lots of great records at that time. But again, I think the one that absolutely epitomises the spirit of it all is Long Tall Sally by Little Richard.
Gonna tell that Mary about Uncle John. He claimed he has a misery, but he's having a lot of fun. Oh, baby.
Little Richard and Long Tall Sally, which was in the charts when you were 15, Michael Hard. You went to Llanelli Grammar School and then you got yourself into Cambridge, really, didn't you? Because, I mean, it wasn't something that was necessarily encouraged.
No, it wasn't. I think, in fact, it was regarded as rather presumptuous. My headmaster, I remember, tried hard to persuade me to go to Aberystwyth, but I wanted to have a go and it didn't look as though I was going to make it. I tried several colleges and Peterhouse, which eventually accepted me, was my last shot. I was obviously the first person from my family to go to any university. And, yeah, that was a great moment.
And you'd sat an entrance exam, I'm sure.
Yes.
You'd written an essay. What did you write about?
I wrote an essay entitled Why I Am an Angry Young Man.
And what were you angry about?
The sorts of things that a 17-year-old is angry about. I was angry about hypocrisy.
So you
I don't think it was sort of incredibly radical politically.
But you were a Tory by then. You were a Conservative.
I was. Yes.
And you went up to Cambridge and then joined the party.
Yeah, I didn't really do very much about it until I got to Cambridge. And then, of course, there were a whole lot of other people there who we were all there at the same time.
The Cambridge Mafia.
The Cambridge Mafia. My exact contemporaries were Ken Clark and John Gummer. Norman Fowler was a year ahead of us. Leon Britton was, I think, 2 years ahead of us. Norman Lamont came a year or so later. Mm. At one time, I think there were four or five of us in the cabinet at the same time.
But was it accepted then that you would all go into the House of Commons? Did you sort of agree with each other that's essentially where what you'd like to do?
I think it was fairly clear that that was what we would like to do. I was never certain that I'd be able to do it. Perhaps some of the others were.
So would you describe those 3 years at Cambridge as you know, bringing about a great metamorphosis in the Michael Howard, the boy from Llanelli, possibly with the Welsh accent? I don't know. Did you have a Welsh accent?
Yes, and I still do when I speak to my relatives in Wales. It took a bit of time. I think it probably took most of my first year to find my feet. But after that, yes, I had a ball. Hmm. It was a sort of golden world, and I had a terrific time.
But after Cambridge, you went to the States for a year, and I mean, I just wanted to ask you about this. I gathered that you were tempted to stay there and take a job in Nashville.
I was very interested in jazz when I was there and pop music as well. And I did have a friend who had a friend, so he said, who ran a radio station in Nashville, who said that they would love to have someone with an English accent do a stint as a disc jockey. And I must admit that the prospect of being a disc jockey in Nashville did have its attractions, but I knew that I wanted to come back and came back.
Get on with real life.
That's right.
Record number four.
Record number four is very much from the time I spent in the States. I used to listen to a lot of jazz when I lived in New York, and I used to go to the Five Spot Cafe in St. Mark's Square and listen to Thelonious Monk, and Blue Monk is a great piece of music.
Thelonious Monk and Blue Monk live at the Five Spot, and memories of your time in the States. You stood, Michael, as a young man in his mid and late 20s in two elections, 1966 and 1970, in a seat that you were never going to win, Edge Hill, Liverpool. There was not a hope in Edge Hill for you, really, was there? So you hunkered down and got on with your career in the law. I read that you applied for 40 winnable constituencies during that time and failed to be selected until the 40th. Is that right? So many?
I didn't keep count, but it's quite possible. When I came back from America for about 5 years or a bit more, I really rather neglected the bar.
But you kept trying to get selected these 40 times.
I did. I thought that either what I'd done up to then would be enough to get me a seat or it wouldn't. But I had to give the bar a fair crack of the whip. Mm. To be honest, I'd more or less reconciled myself to the fact that I wasn't ever going to get in.
But during that time, the Cambridge Mafia we talked about, the Gummer and Fowler and Britton and Clark and so on, all got in 1970, I think, or thereabouts, I think. You must have thought to yourself, you know, why not me?
Well, it is a very sort of random process. But anyway, in the end, it all happened.
It all happened. Long struggle, 17 years, and finally in 1983 you got in as MP for Folkestone and Hythe, and you were 42 years old. So how did it feel to get there at last?
That was an election in which we had a very big majority. I think we had 100 new Conservative members of Parliament. And I remember getting there and looking round at these new colleagues of mine, most of whom were younger than I was, and I thought to myself, how on earth can I possibly make any kind of a mark here? And even for a fleeting moment, wondered whether I'd done the right thing. But it turned out OK.
You were obviously very good at the job and you rose quickly through the ranks. I think you were in the cabinet before you were 50. So, you were just on the right course.
Yes.
OK. Record number five.
Well, record number five goes back to my years as a candidate in Liverpool, where when I went for selection, they said to me, do you have any real connection with Liverpool? And I said, I don't have any real connection with Liverpool. But I said, thinking it would do me some good, but it was also the truth. Ever since I've been a small boy, I have been a passionate supporter of Liverpool Football Club. There was then a deathly hush. Every single person in the room was an Everton supporter. And I thought that had absolutely done me in. And I think the fact that they selected me despite that was probably the single greatest political achievement of my entire career. And I'd go and stand on the Kop on Saturday afternoon and watch the great Liverpool team of the mid-60s play. So my fifth record is You'll Never Walk Alone.
What else? Alone by Jerry and the Pacemakers. So you were Secretary of State for Employment and then Environment and then Home Secretary before the Tory party went into meltdown in 1997. And you might have succeeded John Major as leader, but it was Anne Widdecombe and that terrible phrase, there's something of the night about him, that did for you, wasn't it? It sort of sucked the lifeblood out of your political career, temporarily, as it turned out.
I don't know that it was just that, but it certainly didn't help.
Absolutely. But it wasn't just that she impugned your integrity, because in a sense you could see that off, and you did see that off. It was that it seemed to sort of ring a bell with your colleagues, didn't it?
Well, you go into this business of politics with your eyes open. You know it's a rough and tough business, and you have to take these things on the chin.
Can you ever forgive her?
Oh, yes. Of course, we've had several perfectly friendly discussions since then.
Perfectly friendly?
No, seriously. Yes, seriously. Yeah, of course.
Really?
Yeah, it's part of political life.
OK, you're very stoical about it all. But in the end, of course, you must be right, because it didn't count, because in the end the call did come and you are leader.
It's a huge privilege. And since I'm someone who, for better or for worse, has very clear ideas about what I want to do, I was obviously delighted to have the opportunity of putting those ideas before the people of the country and hoping that they got us elected so that we can put them into practice.
But speaking totally personally for one moment, this is your personal game plan. Do you regard the next election as your one and only chance? If you don't pull it off, you step down.
I don't know, and I don't think about that, because I am really completely focused on doing everything I can do to win the next election. And I'm not prepared to start thinking about what the consequences of failure are, because it will be failure. I am not in this job to reduce the government's majority or improve the standing of the Conservative Party. I'm in this job to win the next election, and I don't really think about what might happen if there was some other outcome.
What would happen, whether you win it or lose it, is that you'd be of pensionable age by the following election. I mean, does that concern you?
That is an indisputable fact.
It is,
absolutely.
It's also indisputable that we've had prime ministers of pensionable age and well beyond in the past. Not anymore, though. It's not the vogue anymore, is it?
Well, you know, they have them in other countries, but who knows? Let's not go down that road.
So do you think the extent of your defeat, were it to be defeat, would dictate whether you stood down or not?
I'm not thinking about defeat.
Well, we'll talk about that in a second, but let's pause for some more music.
Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21 is a sublimely beautiful piece of music, and I love it. I first came across it, I'm ashamed to say, because everybody ought to know it from an early age, when I went to see a film called Elvira Madigan, and it was the theme of that film. And it's just terrific, and I'd like the Alfred Brendel version, please. Thank you.
Part of the second movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21, played by Alfred Brendel with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Sir Neville Mariner. There's an electoral Everest to climb, isn't there, Michael Howard, if you're to win the next general election, with a year, two at the most, to go, and you're really only in the foothills. Short of a major catastrophe in the Labour ranks, it's not going to happen, is it?
Oh, I don't agree with that. Everest has been climbed many times.
But a swing that you require has not occurred ever, has it?
Well, it has, really. You look at the elections for the London Assembly, and London has never really been regarded as our favourite hunting ground. On those results, we would have an overall majority. On the local election results, the country as a whole, we'd be not very far short of
this
an overall
is,
majority.
This is picking and choosing a bit, though, isn't it? I mean, the national polls show that you are in the mid-30%, as it were, and then you need to be in the 40s if you're going to sweep them out of power.
Well, we need to be about 11 points ahead of them. On the local election results, we were 12 points ahead of them. So I am absolutely certain it can be done. Of course, whether it will be done is up to the British people.
But the truth of your leadership is that it's given a huge amount of new heart to the parliamentary party, but that hasn't translated into votes as far as these polls are concerned, has it? That's your problem. How do you get from here to there?
Right. I mean, it has translated into votes to some extent, as the recent election results demonstrate, but not enough. Of course, not enough. And of course, we have a lot to do between now and the next election. I'm quite confident that we can do it. I think that people have lost faith in the present government. Now, that's not enough for us to win. We have to convince people that we are a credible alternative who will really make things happen for them, will really make a difference to their lives. Now, I think we're making progress towards achieving that. We haven't yet achieved it. I fully accept we've got some way to go, and I'm convinced we can do it.
But you must dream of a stroke of luck. I mean, what might it be? A change of Labour leadership? That's not going to happen now, is it? You must, you know, governments lose elections. Oppositions don't win them. We know that.
No, I don't entirely agree with that. I think you need both. You need, obviously, if the people of a country think their government's doing wonderful things for them, an opposition isn't going to win an election. But it's not enough just for people to lose faith in their government. They also have to have faith in the alternative. And we have not yet done everything we need to do in order to get to that point. But I'm confident we can get to that point, and then it will be up to the people to choose.
Record number seven.
Record number seven really takes us back to the 60s, I'm afraid. It does. I suppose I listened to more music in that decade than since. Procol Harum and A Whiter Shade of Pale. It's a great track. We skip the light fandango. Turns cartwheels across the floor. I was feeling kind of seasick.
Procol Harum and A Whiter Shade of Pale. I can't quite see you on a desert island, Michael Howard, coping with life in the raw, or am I missing something here? Is this another false perception?
No, I'd be absolutely useless. Shortly after my father married my mother, he tried to fix something in the bathroom, punctured the plumbing of the entire house, caused an enormous flood, used that as an excuse for the rest of his life not to do anything in the house, and I regard that excuse as hereditary.
What I do know is that you would miss your wife of 30 years, Sandra, hugely, and I know this because I read that you're romantic. She said so in various profiles in the newspapers. You wooed her with a book in the first instance, I read.
When we first met, I discovered that she hadn't read Tender is the Night, and I thought that was a pity because I think it's a great novel. And so I sent her a copy.
And that did the trick.
Well, I don't know whether it was entirely due to that.
It's a touch of Scott Fitzgerald and she was yours. I get the impression that you've obviously been very happy, are very happy, but that you regard your life together as separate from your politics, as it were. You know, politics is something really, rather like the law that you go out and do, and then you come home and life is life. Is it?
Yes. I mean, you've got to try and have some private space, and it's difficult, but you've got to try not to let politics completely take everything over. And we do discuss everything, and she has, you know, she has views, which she expresses quite forcefully. I don't always agree with her. But
I just wonder if that's why, you know, there's been this gap in perception that I was talking about earlier, that in fact you've regarded your politics rather like being an adversarial lawyer. It's something you go out and do, and at home you're witty and charming, and out there you're a kind of different character. Do you think that's where this gap has occurred?
I don't know. Pass.
Pass. All right. Well, now, in fact, the two lives must fuse because life is taken over by being leader, isn't it? I mean, you must
pretty much
eat, drink, sleep, live it. Can't avoid it.
It's difficult. There are moments that you can grab, and they're very important, and we do, but it is pretty all-consuming.
But a happy business?
Yes. Some days are more enjoyable than others. But yes, no,
I hope this is a happy one.
It is indeed. No, it's, you know, I'm incredibly fortunate and privileged to be doing what I'm doing. And
Are you enjoying it, is really what I'm asking.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. A lot.
Last record.
Well, the last record is Bryan Adams' Everything I Do It For You. Whatever little I've achieved, I couldn't have done it without Sandra, so this is dedicated to her.
Great stuff. Good for the last dance of the evening.
Absolutely.
Bryan Adams and Everything I Do It For You. So if you could only take one of those records, need I ask, really?
Yeah, it has to be the last one, doesn't it?
What about your book?
Well, there's the best political biography that I've ever read is, it's going to be in five volumes eventually. Only three of them have come out. It's by Robert Caro. It's a biography of Lyndon Johnson. And I don't think you've put a date as to when I get to this desert island. So I hope that by the time I get there, all five volumes will have been published.
OK, and a luxury.
A hot shower and some soap, please.
Michael Howard, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Sue.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.